On episode 406 of the 40 Plus Fitness podcast, we meet Lisa Boucher and discuss her book, Raising the Bottom. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/406. Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go. Our guest today walked away from alcohol in her late 20s and since has become a registered nurse and is helping hundreds and hundreds of people overcome addiction to alcohol and drugs. With no further ado, here's our guest, Lisa Boucher. Lisa, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you, Alan. Happy to be here.
You know, we're getting into that time of the year when there's holidays and, you know, we're going to have Thanksgiving coming up. And of course, then after that, there's all the Christmas parties and then, of course, New Year's. And, you know, we associate all of these holidays, all these events with alcohol.
Yeah. And you forgot Halloween, because that's becoming a huge alcohol. I know when I was raising my sons, my husband, we're still together and he's a drinker. And when they were taking the kids around when they were little, we had I had a problem with the happy hour at every single house. So the parents would have their kids dressed up in their little costumes and each house would offer a cocktail. And I said, uh-uh. So I ended up making my husband stay home and give out the candy. And I took the kids, because by the time you get around, we had a big circle, half the parents could barely stand. So it starts, I mean, there's just no holiday, there's no event that doesn't say, hey, it's all about the parents and we got to drink too. So what are we role modeling?
And you know, I moved to Boca del Toro and, you know, there's an expat community here and, you know, we get together and we have dinners and go out and watch our friends, you know, perform and you know, but it's kind of a cycle of things of it. All of this is always going to involve alcohol, you know, bring your own beer, bring your own wine kind of mindset to all of it.
We live in a boozy culture. And, you know, for your listeners, I'm not opposed to drinking moderately, but I think, Alan, we have normalized alcoholism in a lot of ways. And what I mean by that is I quit drinking before I was a daily drinker. And I'm around a lot of people that drink daily, and I'm not talking just one drink a day. They're drinking 4 or 5 drinks a day, and they walk around saying, well, I'm a social drinker. Well, actually, that's more like getting into alcohol dependence, alcohol abuse. They may not be full-blown alcoholics, but it can have a detrimental impact on a life when, if you're going to work, they say 80% of alcoholics have families and have jobs. So if your life looks like something like you go to work and every night after work, especially when you live in the tropical place like you do, if every day your social life, your after work life is at a bar drinking for the rest of the evening, at some point, by making that choice, you're choosing not to do a whole lot of other things. And so I just encourage people to say, is this really what I want to do? Or am I just going along with the flow? I know when I quit drinking, there's so many things that I have found to do. I just went to a bird lecture this morning. I mean, it's kind of a nerdy thing to do, but I'm really interested in nature and the birds and things that when I was drinking, I didn't even see the blue sky or the birds. I didn't notice. I wasn't really present on a daily basis or moment to moment in my life. So there's a lot of things that you miss too with the drinking. And it's just a matter of really rethinking all the drinks and saying, is this who I want to be? Is this how I want to spend my time? And I know with like the people that do get sober, there's a lot of deep, heartfelt regret of the things that they missed or the things they didn't do with their family, with their children, with their spouse or significant other, because drinking can take up a lot of time. And I sobered up in my late 20s, and I literally just squandered that whole decade of my 20s when you're trying to set up your life. And I had a lot of regrets about that, but much less so than someone who waits till they're 45, 50, even 60 to get sober.
Yeah, you had a statistic in the book that just it kind of hit me in the face. It was 10% of the population is an addict or an alcoholic.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. So think about it. Here in the United States, we have about 320 million people, roughly. So there are truly about 32 million addicts and alcoholics. And that's probably underreported, because there's a lot of people like me. I did not go to rehab. I did not go to the doctor. I knew about this disease by being raised by an alcoholic mother. So I've been entrenched in this whole thing from birth, my whole life. And I've had siblings who were addicts and alcoholics. And now that I've been sober 30 years, I work with a lot of people in recovery. My first husband was a raging alcoholic. So I've just been around this. And they say, and I'm also a registered nurse. So here's another scary stat, is 14% of doctors. So I've noticed working in healthcare, there are so many doctors, nurses, anesthesiologists that end up in recovery. So that's a pretty high stat, 14% of doctors and 10%, like I said in the book, of the general population. So these are people, and the people that I focused on in my book are people that you would never suspect they had a drinking problem, because I think that's why more people aren't finding recovery. There's this stigma. There's this picture in our heads of an addict is the person, the homeless guy on the street, the people that are passing out in cars that we see on the 6 o'clock news. And that is one face of addiction, but that is at the end stage. So I wanted to focus on the people, again, that were more like myself, or the 80% functional alcoholics. For instance, Caro, I have 10 stories in the back of the book of various women and a guy. She was a surgeon. She was coming home every day, making dinner, had two children that were well-dressed, well-fed, in good schools, lives in a great neighborhood. All of these trappings that we look at from the outside facade and say, oh, that's a great life. However, inside, she's falling apart. Her kids are miserable. They can't stand her drinking. They are losing respect for her. And she finally, one day, just came home from work, started to open that bottle of wine and said, you know what? She went back, didn't drink that day, went back to the hospital, told her partners, hey, I think I have a problem. These are two other surgeons. And they're response was they were like, surely you jest, this can't be. So this is the attitudes of what we've got going out there, and still working in healthcare a couple days a week. I like to keep my foot in so I can tell you what's going on currently. And the attitudes are shameful. People come to the hospital, they are not getting the help they need. They get a lot of the times, all this anxiety, depression, unhappiness. The underlying issue is substance abuse, drinking too much, taking perhaps too many prescription medications like Xanax, Valium, Ativan. These benzos do not help a person's life go well. A lot of times they're meant for anxiety, and people get rebound anxiety, which is even worse than their original anxiety. So all of these medications are not helping. And what I'm still seeing is the doctors are throwing medicine at these people They leave the hospital. Their lives continue to spiral out of control. They're unhappy. They're gaining weight. They're losing their marriages. They're losing their children. It is a mess. And the doctors, though, still rarely address the underlying issue of substance abuse. And I'm saying, Alan, we need to get people clean and sober before we start labeling them with anxiety and depression diagnosis, because that is what happened to my mother back in the 60s, who was also an RN. She went and got on Valium, which was the pharmaceutical industry's first billion-dollar drug. That led into a 25-year addiction that escalated into alcohol to where she was non-functional. My mom was the woman laying on the floor like you would see in Wine and Roses. You know, she was a hot mess. So this is where it led for her. And so 10 years into my nursing career, I really started to wake up and I'm looking around and I said, my God, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. And let's not forget, there's children on the backside of all of these men and women who are caught up in addiction. So we are, in essence, cultivating a whole new generation of addicts and alcoholics, because growing up in these environments with drug and alcohol-fueled parents, I know as a child, I was traumatized by it. My father was rather abusive. He's trying to control my mother's alcoholism, which is absolutely uncontrollable. She was incapable of parenting. So we basically raised ourselves. I have two older sisters and a younger brother, and we've all been touched by addiction in our own lives. So this, you know, we're just perpetuating the mess. And so celebrating all these boozy outings and events, it's like, what happens behind the scenes? Is anybody aware of that? Does anybody care?
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, you know, the times that, you know, where I would think, you know, I kind of get, for a lack of a better word, dependent on the alcohol, is I'm very much an introvert. And so if I'm going to go to a party or an event, which obviously here on the island is all the time, you know, a couple of drinks makes me human, from their perspective. When I'm not drinking, you know, there's always, my wife will get some questions. It's like, what's wrong with Alan? And she's like, no, this is just, if he hasn't had a couple drinks, give him a couple drinks and he'll be nice. He'll be a normal person. In small groups and one-on-ones, I'm fine. But when I get into larger groups or, you know, in places with people, I shut down. And so the alcohol kind of just helps me loosen up a little bit.
Well, I get it. I think you're not alone. I think the majority, I know that I was very similar when I was drinking. It's like you have to have a few drinks before you get to the party. But when I got sober, I started to, number one, be true to myself. So I'm not a big, large gathering kind of person. I stopped going to a lot of them. My husband's more of an extrovert, and I talk about this in the book. So how do you juggle a relationship, a marriage, whatever, when one person drinks and one person's social and the other one is kind of out like you, Alan? So I just told my husband, there's, you know, pick a few parties that we are regularly invited to that you really want me to go to and I'll go. And the ones that are just, I don't feel the need to go anymore. I prefer more meaningful activities, smaller intimate dinners or gatherings. Like I said, I just have other things that I do with my time now than suffer through some huge event or gathering that I really don't want to be at to begin with. So it's picking and choosing and being true to myself. And, you know, I started to, when you work on your inner self, and some of the drinking was fueled by low self-esteem. Some of my drinking was fueled by thinking people are focused on me, this self-centeredness that alcoholism breeds, where we think people are going to notice us or look at us. And so we're self-conscious. But the reality is most people are in their own heads, focused on their own stuff, and they're really not paying attention to us. I used to say that to my, I have two grown sons now, but when they were in high school, my one son was always so worried what everybody else would think. And I used to say to him, they're not focused on you. get out of yourself. I mean, you're just another kid walking by. They're not even paying attention to you. And I hope that that helped them get some of that spotlight off of thinking that people are focused on them when they're really not, when they're really not. So we can find other ways to love ourselves and just to say, no, it's okay to say no and just not do certain things that I don't want to do anymore.
Yes. Now, in the book, and you're coming from a woman's perspective, but in this book was somewhat written more for women and their perspective. Why is alcohol more of an issue for women than it might be for men?
Well, I don't know that it is actually. In Raising the Bottom, I focus more on women only because I am a woman and I can intimately relate it to. But I will tell you, before I scare off the guys, there's men love the book. Men love Raising the Bottom. In fact, there was a guy who found it in Seattle. He's a merchant marine. He took it out to sea with him. He found me on Twitter months later and said it was life-changing for him. And he's still sober, by the way. So I think men really like it because they can read it and almost say like, wow, I can relate to all of this without feeling threatened at all. So I don't want to scare men off by reading the book, but I can relate to more of the women's issues in how we're responsible a lot of times for family and we get a lot of things dumped on our shoulders. And I know men have stressors as much too, but I will say this, it seems like men do better at saying, hey, buddy, I quit drinking. And their friends kind of respect that boundary, I think, better than women. Because I have a lot of women that tell me they really struggle with their so-called friend groups who don't really want to be friends with them once they quit drinking and all this. And I find that so disheartening for many reasons. Number one, if your friend group is of that mentality, they're probably super heavy drinkers. And they probably, I know when I was drinking, I hung out with people who drank like me. I was not hanging out with normal drinkers. And so I didn't realize there were people who didn't drink like I did, that there were people who might have drinks a couple times a month and then that was it. And they were the true social drinkers who had a big life and were involved in many other things, and their life did not revolve around alcohol. So the people that I socialized with were very much different, and we drank every night and had parties and gatherings, and we called ourselves social drinkers. So when you have women that, like I said, want to boot people out or say they can't be friends or whatnot. And women seem to care about that. And I tell them, well, you don't need those people, then find new friends. And I don't know why that's so threatening to some. And I think in order to change your life, to get sober, to maybe drink less, whatever it is that you decide you want to do, you have to be willing to face a little bit of pushback, which leads me to, as adults, why are we pushing back? Why do we have to have this peer pressure, this adult peer pressure? When I used to go to gatherings early in my recovery, and I'm so uncomfortable anyway, because you feel this shame because you're like quitting drinking. And I don't, now I look back and go, oh my goodness, what was I thinking? But it's like we feel shame for doing something good for ourselves. If you go to a party and they have all these sweets and you refuse a sweet, nobody questions you. But if you go and you refuse a drink, you get the 20 questions. If you're a young woman, oh, are you pregnant? Oh, why aren't you drinking? Oh, are you on medication? I mean, it's ridiculous. And so I tell people, men and women, no is a complete sentence. No, thank you. We don't need to explain ourselves. And if somebody has a problem with me not drinking, it's usually because they have a drinking problem and they're very uncomfortable with that mirror of someone not drinking to kind of almost co-sign on their BS. So we can navigate these drinking. I go wherever I want. I do what I want. I have a very big life. but I just don't drink. And for the most part, nobody really cares. Like I said, the only people who have ever really cared that I'm not drinking are people that ended up having their own problems with alcohol.
Yeah. Now, this last month, we ran a challenge, and I included an alcohol piece to it. And I didn't say completely abstain from alcohol, but we're going to cut it back and continue to kind of regress it and cut it back. I've had no alcohol challenges in the past, and the turnout is relatively small. So it'll be interesting as people get into, you know, so the results of going through the challenge, people are improving their health, they're losing weight. You know, that's part of the gist of the whole thing. So alcohol, you know, I think we all know alcohol can lead to weight gain, and stopping drinking can actually help you on your weight loss journey. But there are other health things that we should consider with regards to alcohol. Could you kind of get into some of that?
Well, I mean, oh my gosh, alcohol impacts really every organ in our body. So let's quit deluding ourselves and say, oh, it's not that bad. It causes 7 types of cancer. That's been proven definitively. Alcohol is a class 1 carcinogen. So it is in the same class as asbestos. Now, nobody is going to tell you that. And the research on that is if you Google it, you're going to have to dig a little bit because that's not something that pops up immediately. But oh, believe me, it's there. So in addition to, like, for men, there's a lot of throat cancers, esophageal cancers, stomach cancers, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, and women with breast cancer. I know when I got into recovery, here again, I started paying attention and I'm like, oh my God, so much breast cancer in these women. And then years later, I'm researching, doing all this research for Raising the Bottom, and the light bulb went out and I went, well, my God, no wonder all these alcoholic women have breast cancer. It's the booze. I mean, we can't say for sure that it's the sole cause. I'm sure there's environmental factors. Stress is a huge one, but a lot of people drink because they can't handle their stress, because they don't have good coping skills. So it all ties in together. You've got people, when I was working in the ER, people who are diabetic, drinking heavily, their blood sugars are all over the place. They're coming into the hospital because now they're having kidney failure from their unchecked diabetes because they were drinking too much. They're getting coronary artery disease from their unchecked diabetes because they couldn't stop drinking so much. So there are so many ways that alcohol turns to sugar in our body. So you're just getting this bombardment of sugar, which causes inflammation. Let's move on to the brain. The extended care facilities, nursing homes are filled with people who have a long history of drinking. A lot of alcoholics end up in the nursing homes. A lot of people with long-term benzo abuse, or I don't even want to say abuse, but people tend to get on those benzos and they stay on them for the next 30 years because the withdrawal to get off is so awful. They just stay on them. And I think that's how they were designed by the pharmaceutical companies. So they give you this benzo when you're 25 to help you not feel anxious. And when you're 60, you're still taking it. And pretty soon the mind just goes to mush. So these are things that people don't really understand about health and what it can do. In the last 5 years, I've seen a big uptick in women that are yellow, because women do not have, we lack the chemical that helps to break down alcohol. Men have more of the it's a tongue twister for me to say. It's ADH is the short, but we women lack ADH. Men have more of it. So that's why men can kind of skate along and drink maybe a little longer and a little harder without it totally impacting them physically like it will a woman. Women go downhill much faster. And that's, I talk a lot about that in Raising the Bottom, because that was instrumental for me, why I got sober when I did, because I saw how quickly once my mother crossed that line from drinking martinis at lunch to becoming a full-blown alcoholic, her demise was swift. She ended up looking like she was 9 months pregnant. Her skin was yellow. She was dying. She was dying. And that happened in a span of 5 years. So I'm seeing a lot more of that I didn't see 10 or 15 years ago. I've been in healthcare for 25 years now. So that is new. And it's all attributed, I believe, to the alcohol, big alcohol is doing a very, very good job of spending their billions of dollars in ad budgets to target women. And so the new alcoholic often is well-educated. She makes a good living. She wears designer pumps and she carries a diaper bag. And this is the new alcoholic of what we're facing. So now let me ask you this, Alan. What happens to those children on the backside of this boozy mom? Well, they end up like me, probably will land in their own addiction later on, because when you have a mother who's all about the party time, you're not present. You're missing a lot of the nuances that I know with my twins, I was able to pick up on. I was 2 weeks sober when I found out I was pregnant with twins. And I'm so grateful that I was a sober mom who was fully present. Both my sons went on to become Division I athletes. Both of my sons went to college. They graduated college playing football. And I can just assure you, it would have been a very, very different picture had I not been sober. Our family would have been very different.
Now, there are a lot of people that will say, okay, you know what, and I don't drink that much. You know, I just have a couple drinks here and there. Like you said, social drinkers. I was actually reading a study the other day, or there's actually several studies out there that show that we're really not good at self-reporting what we eat, what we drink. So, you know, if they ask you what you had for dinner last week in general, you're going to underreport your calories. You're going to report more healthy food than you actually ate. And if you drank alcohol, you're probably going to report less drinks than you probably drank. But, you know, alcoholism is actually something that unless you self-diagnose, nothing's going to change for you.
And you're absolutely right. So what changed my life was getting honest with myself. Because the standard alcoholic answer is, I had two. Oh, I only had two beers. I only had two drinks. They always only have two. So you're right. People lie. And so that's why doctors that are tuned in, most doctors are clueless about alcoholism. Some of the stuff that comes out of the psychiatrist's mouth that I hear, it just drives me crazy. They'll say things like, oh, they used to be an alcoholic, but now they just are using meth or something crazy like that. So like they just switched addictions is what they did. But back to your point. Yeah. So we lie. Alcoholics lie. We all know that. If you want to change your life, be honest. I knew 2 years before I quit drinking that I was drinking too much, that I was crossing a line. I had a home bar that I loved and I knew everybody, kind of like on Cheers, everyone knew my name. And when we used to go in there and start asking the person sitting on my right and left, who are, by the way, drinking right along with me, and say, do you think I drink too much? And of course, they're like, oh, heck no, you're fine. You know, what are they going to say? Yeah, you're drinking, you know, so, but that was those early warning signs. Something was not resonating within my soul. And I knew that it was not, I don't even want to say abnormal, but it was abnormal for me, because it's like, people get so caught up on quantity. Like I said, I was not a daily drinker. I did not drink a fifth a day. However, when I drank, I get a few drinks in me. There were times I absolutely could stop and I would be your designated driver. And there were other times I could not stop. So there was that unpredictability factor, which is indicative of potential alcoholism. There was the fact of how it affected my personality. I'm a pretty even-keeled person. I'm not a drama queen by any stretch, give me a few drinks and oh, we're going to have drama. It's either going to be, I'm going to create something. I'm going to start a fight. I'm going to shoot my mouth off inappropriately. Pick anything. I would just do and say things that I never would do and say sober. So that was another clue to me. I was losing my moral compass. That was another tip off where you start to rationalize and justify lying. You know, I don't know. I was never really a thief, but I'm sure that could have come where, you know, you take 20 bucks out of your husband's wallet and don't bother to tell him, hey, I took 20 bucks. And you start, you know, I didn't do that then, but I could see where I could have maybe segued into that kind of behavior. And we tend to rationalize things like, oh, that's fine. That's fine. Well, no, actually in sobriety, it's about getting rigorously honest, living right, doing the right thing. And so I was really losing my way that way. And I don't know that I would have saw it as early as I did had, again, my mother was instrumental in my recovery because she sobered up when I was in my early 20s, and I saw her change dramatically. So by the time I got sober, my mother had 7 years sobriety under her belt, and she had morphed into this amazing mom that I think I wished I always had. But so yeah, it can impact us in so many ways. And I just really want people to understand, you've got to throw out all these old ideas that an alcoholic has to look a certain way, because no, there are no demographics, there are no boundaries. And I'll tell you, the worst nightmare for an alcoholic is money. There's a lot of alcoholism. My father goes to Bonita Springs in the winter, and I go down there. So you've got a lot of affluent people in the Naples, Sarasota area. And as a nurse, I see the loose blouses and the big livers and the guys in their golf shirts with their big livers sticking out. And it's just, oh my God, I almost can't stand it, because there's just so much, their lives are golfing and drinking and eating. And there's going to be a lot of, you know, earlier deaths, because this is what they do when they, this is their social life, which is fine, but it's scary in a lot of ways to me when I see how sick some of these people look and they don't even see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in your recovery and in your mother's recovery, you utilized the 12 step.
I did. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So even though that wasn't on our plan, can you kind of just quickly kind of go through, because I think you kind of hit on some of those points of getting honest with yourself. And I think the 12 steps is actually kind of that approach to actually making that happen and making it real in your life, not just an exercise you do over the course of a weekend at a seminar, but this is something that you have to live and do over the course of a quite a long time.
Right. It becomes a way of life, Alan. I know people go to rehab, and I just need to throw this out there. So many people go to rehab and their families think, oh, they're cured. No. No, that is just the tip of the iceberg, because a lot of people go to rehab just to get people off their back and they have no intention of really doing the hard work. It takes working on the core inside issues, however you choose to do that. I like the 12 step because it gives you a roadmap to do that. And really the first step is we have to admit we have a problem. So I don't care what recovery method you're going to use, smart recovery, whatever, you have to admit you have a problem, because you can't, I mean, it's almost like someone who's overweight, you have to admit, okay, I decide I need to lose weight. And until you're ready to accept that about yourself, you're not going to change it. And then the 12 steps really help a person look at their issues. So what were some of mine? Mine were, I was a very fear-based person, which I didn't realize that. So I had to look at how, as a child, my predominant emotion was fear. And I covered up with that fear with a lot of false bravado, a big mouth, that kind of thing. So I had to look at that. I had to forgive my parents. They did the best they could. I didn't think they did a great job raising me, since I did kind of raise myself along with my siblings. Now I have a sister who stayed in addiction 40 years because she couldn't, she liked to blame my parents as opposed to taking responsibility as an adult. Okay, our childhood wasn't great, but it could have been worse. And I'm an adult now, and I'm going to make the choice to make my life better and be a different parent to my children. And my sister couldn't do that. So yeah, you have to. And then it's about, it really focuses too on getting out of yourself. I mean, alcoholism is, we have to get humble. It's the I'm going to do it my way disease. It's a disease that is riddled with pride. People can be almost homeless and they still think they know what they're doing. They're unwilling to listen. They've lost four jobs. They're on their third marriage and they still swear they don't have a problem. That you see over and over again. Anybody who's been married more than, well, even three times, it's usually alcohol is in the picture there somewhere. One of the persons involved was drinking. And my older sister, she's on her third marriage. Yep, alcohol's been involved in her each one of those marriages. So we have to get honest about, we can't blame everybody else. It comes back to, what are we covering up inside of us and dealing with that and working on the issues, having that humility to say, I can't do this, making amends to the people that we have harmed, people, moms especially, they say, oh, I'm not harming anyone. Well, yes, you are, because your kids may be well fed and you might get them to their soccer practices. But when you're standing on the sidelines with a cocktail in your hand, you're not really focused on the present moment. You're focused on, oh, when this cocktail's empty, I got to haul over to my friend's cooler and get a refill. And it's just a very selfish, myopic way of life, the drinking life. And most people don't really see it until they do get sober. And then the last factor is it's about helping others and doing it freely and willingly and giving of, you know, I work with a lot of women. Recovery coaching is like really big now. I don't charge because it was freely given to me. And so it's an honor and a privilege to help a woman who is struggling, who says they want to change their life, and then to give them some simple directions that they follow and their lives begin to change in amazing ways. So that is a gift. So it's really a way of life, and it's part of my life that I've just incorporated into my life. And it's just who I am and what I do. I go to meetings 3 a week. I work with others and I write books, and I'm still a nurse sometimes.
Lisa, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are 3 strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
The obvious, Alan, exercise, eat right. But here are the 3 that I think are really helpful. Number 1, stop people-pleasing. Because that, a lot of times people-please, then they have resentments, which fuels eating and drinking and anger. So people are very angry. So stop people pleasing. If you really don't want to do something, I mean, other than things that like we have to do, like go to work or whatever, but stop people pleasing so that you're not resentful. Number 2, get engaged in something outside of yourself. As I said, help others. People are depressed. They're anxious. Well, when you're only focused on your own depression and anxiety, it almost fuels it. Whereas if you're focused on helping somebody else, getting out of yourself, the anxiety and depression is cut in half. So I would suggest find something, find a hobby, find a way to help others, and you will watch your happiness quotient expand exponentially. And number 3, which is no problem for you down there in Panama, get out in nature. People, 89% of adults spend 15 minutes or less a day in nature. Oh my gosh, no wonder we're drinking, right? Because you're in these sterile environments, be it an office or whatever, and then you go from that to your car to your house. And I don't think, I mean, let's go back to hunters and gatherers. We're meant to be outdoors. You know, the trees, the greenery, there is a chemical in this greenery called phytosines, and it is proven. In Japan, they call it Shinrin-yoku, They don't give out a lot of antidepressants in Japan. They prescribe nature walks and forest bathing. So this phytosine in the trees helps to increase your immunity, decrease depression, decrease anxiety. So why are we not doing more of these sorts of things? And for the drinkers, no, this does not mean you go sit under a palm tree and have five drinks. That doesn't count. But maybe go walk amongst the butterflies. Or I think you mentioned early, maybe before we start taping, that you have a rainforest nearby. I mean, what a gift. I can't imagine how amazing that would be to walk through this rainforest with all this nature chirping and chattering above your head. These are things that really can make you feel so much better. And I wonder if people just, if they decided to do something like that every day, as opposed to drink five drinks, maybe have one drink after you go on a nature walk, and maybe that'd be enough, and you just have a drink, your life could be really different. And just something as small as those sorts of little changes can have huge impacts when you realize, like, wow, I took that walk and I was fully present and engaged in my surroundings. I mean, I can't tell you how many people get sober and say, oh my God, for the first time in my life, I smelled winter. Or I saw spring. This is what alcohol, taking alcohol out of a life can do. It's like ripping off the veil or the scales. It's like you see things just totally different.
Lisa, thank you so much. If someone wanted to get in touch with you, learn more about the book, learn more about what you're doing, where would you like for me to send them?
They can go to my website, raisingthebottom.com. I'm on Facebook under Lisa Boucher, award-winning author. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at Raising the Bottom.
Okay. Well, you can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/406, and I'll be sure to have the links there. So Lisa, thank you so much for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you, Alan. This was a pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you.
As I record this, I'm actually sitting in my hotel in Columbus, Ohio. I was here for the Author Academy Awards. Sadly, I didn't win. But on a high note, the guy that did win, I'm really happy for him. His name is Dr. David Friedman. I've actually had him on the podcast. He was episode number 331. His book, Food Sanity, is actually my favorite health book. I would put it on the top of my list going all the way back. And obviously, with all the authors I've had on this show, you know that I've read a lot of health and fitness books, and Food Sanity is by far the best book out there. So I'm not ashamed to lose to Dr. Friedman. Actually, he and I have become really good friends, and I was really happy to see him there and really happy to see him win this award. And he's a hoot. So do check out that episode 331. Well worth a listen. But while I was here, I was also in a business conference, and part of that business conference got me to asking a question of myself. And that was, is what I'm doing as a health and fitness expert really helping you reach your health and fitness goals? And I've been pondering that thought for a while since, you know, at least over the last few days as I've been in this conference. And the answer is I'm not quite sure. And so I'm asking you, you're listening to this, you've listened through the whole podcast, and I really, really appreciate you. But I'll ask you the question, and please do email me at alan@40plusfitnesspodcast.com. And let me know, am I meeting your needs? Am I giving you what you need to reach your health and fitness goals? And, you know, give me a little bit of detail on that. That'll really help me understand what I need to bring to the podcast, what I need to bring to my services, and just what I can do to help you. So please do email me at alan@40plusfitnesspodcast.com and let me know if I'm helping you meet your health and fitness goals. Thank you. Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we bring on fitness icon Denise Austin and discuss wellness into our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.